world and local news events, but because of social media and the constant barrage of information that comes through every electronic device in our possession, we allow ourselves to be flooded with material that is not helping us. Spend 15 minutes at most at the beginning and the end of each day on current events. If you want to dig deeper into a particular subject, you know I am all for learning. However, don't drown in news you can do little or nothing about. 5. Engage your community. When you get out of your own head and into your community, meeting people and lending a helping hand, it's a lot harder to dwell on perceived slights that happened to you. The bonus is that community involvement often puts you in touch with people who can help and inspire you. Plus, you will have less time to dwell on perceived problems. One of the greatest things I have done recently was to join the board of directors of St. Jude's Ranch for Children in Nevada. Not only is it a terrific organization that helps transform the lives of abused and at-risk children, young adults, and families, but it has also allowed me to connect with many families I would not have otherwise met in my new home state and get to know my amazing fellow board members. It has given me a new and important mission. 6. Question your assumptions. Actively question negative assumptions about your situation. Be consciously proactive and solution-oriented as opposed to reactive to negative events or conditions. Think of your circumstance not as an obstacle, but as an asset. Successful, productive people are masters at making obstacles into resources. If you are having a difficult time with a colleague at work, or if you notice that sales have been slow, or if you keep being turned down for jobs, what are these situations telling you? What are the ways a particular circumstance is an advantage? Is your problematic colleague offering clues to departmental troubles that could be solved by changing procedures? Write them down. What are ways this circumstance could present opportunities? If sales have been slow, is it a chance to reevaluate your inventory and make changes to your buying strategy? How can you make a no into a yes? If you keep being passed over for new opportunities, perhaps it's time to update your skills or revise your resume. Derek Coleman became deaf when he was 3 years old. Now he's an NFL fullback, currently with the Atlanta Falcons. In a great Duracell commercial, he explains how his obstacles became an asset. "I was picked on and picked last," he said. "Coaches didn't know how to talk to me. They gave up on me. Told me I should just quit. They didn't call my name. Told me it was over. But I've been deaf since I was 3, so I didn't listen." What an incredible gift that he could not hear the criticism from the people around him. His deafness has continued to be an asset on the field because the crowd noise is not a distraction for him, as it can be for other hearing players. This was especially crucial when he played for the Seahawks because the Seattle Stadium is considered one of the loudest in the NFL. Although deafness seems like it would be a huge disadvantage for an athlete, it turns out to have some important advantages. Consider, too, that if a circumstance is an issue for you, it is probably troublesome for other people as well. Some of the most profitable businesses come from solving big problems. On-demand transportation services like Uber and Lyft have solved the problem many people have of not having a car or not being able to drive. Both companies were started by individuals who recognized an obstacle, "No ride, dude," and figured out a way around it. A car shows up and takes you where you need to go for an affordable fee. Amazon made online shopping a breeze and continues to innovate. The company is big now, but one guy with a few employees started it. How can solving your problem be turned into a solution not just for you, but also for thousands, millions, and perhaps billions of other people? Location, location, location. One circumstance excuse I hear a lot from people is that they work or live in a lousy location and so can't make their businesses or lives better because they're stuck in that place. If you really think that your location is the problem, you have to do one of two things: move your location or make the location work for you. I've seen businesses in less than desirable locations do very well. The hole in the wall that people go out of their way to visit, passing numerous other places on their way, has something going for it that makes location almost immaterial. Convenience is secondary to experience, and anyone who suggests otherwise is wrong. Half a million people go to Orlando, the middle of nowhere, to visit Disney World on any given day. They stand online in 100-degree heat for half an hour, pay exorbitant prices for a soda, but yet they have fun, and they do it all over again whenever the chance arises. If it is an amazing boutique, bar, restaurant, miniature golf course, whatever is compelling, then people will come. So the trick is to make your place compelling. Charlie Alexander, who owns Moonrunner's Saloon, had to deal with the reality of being in a forgotten part of Garner outside of Raleigh, North Carolina. We are located in an area where no one really goes anymore. Even though Moonrunner's is a destination restaurant, it still does not bring in sufficient numbers to the location, he says. Charlie noticed that on Saturdays and Sundays, the restaurant's sales were declining. He thought that maybe it was because his customers were busy enjoying the massive street fairs and open-air concerts that took place in downtown Raleigh on the weekends. He decided to use this insight to his advantage. We added a food truck and catering to generate additional revenue and customers, he says. We have a presence at these weekend events. Charlie also sends the food truck to the most popular office buildings to provide high-quality $8 to $10 meals to workers. It's not the roach coach going from construction site to construction site, says Charlie. His truck does that during the day, and in the evenings, he partners with craft breweries that don't serve food. We set up in their parking lot, which is another source of revenue and exposure. We are now in the brewery's rotation of food trucks. Moonrunners also does catering. Not the white linen-type wedding catering, but a more casual format, such as backyard weddings and organization events where the restaurant can provide box lunches. Even if people don't stop to eat, Moonrunners benefits from marketing collateral, impressions from the exposure in places where many people gather. Between food truck and catering revenues, by the end of 2017, we made an additional 20 to 25% in sales, and when we maximize what the food truck can do, we expect to see a 35 to 40% increase in sales, says Charlie. Location is really not an excuse. Think about turning your location's faults into its funky assets. I took over a restaurant in Dallas, Texas, several years ago. It had been in the same family for 50 years, and the children had taken it over from their parents. The restaurant had become invisible in its location. Plenty of people drove by, but they were on their way to someplace else. The restaurant was no longer a destination. We were brought in to renovate and update the property. The restaurant was open while we did the work because the family was frugal and did not want to lose customers or revenue while the renovations were happening. As part of the renovations, we painted the outside of the property. The painters came one day and primed the building with a special epoxy primer that happened to be bright pink. They were supposed to come back to put on the final coat, but it rained for several weeks, so their work was postponed. Curiously, during that time when the restaurant was pink, revenues went up 225%. People came in and said, "Oh, I never noticed this place before, even though I've been driving by for 10 years. What I learned from that experience is very important. The location was bad for the restaurant only because the restaurant blended in with its surroundings. Texas is beige and flat. The restaurant was beige. Once it was pink, all of a sudden it had the greatest location in the Lone Star State. And we did paint it eventually, but we kept it a shade of pink." You can find good people. I can't find good people. This is one of the most annoying "that's just the way it is" excuses I hear from business owners. My response: if you can't find the right people, then how the hell do your competitors find them? That's a perfect example of turning an objection into a question. Then answer the question. Maybe they have really good incentive programs. Perhaps your competitors have great scheduling apps that satisfy both part-time workers' need for free time on particular days and coverage for the business when it needs it. Ask the next natural question, which is, why don't good people work for me? Maybe it's because you are unprofessional and therefore have a bad reputation. If that's the issue, we can do something about it. Maybe you have good people working for you, but you don't train them properly and you don't give them feedback or manage them well. Maybe these good people are dying to come out of their shells, but you keep them stuck through lack of communication, bad scheduling, and lack of training. Other reasons you might not have the best staff is because you pay less than your competitors or offer fewer benefits. Even in a buyer's market for jobs, these things still matter a great deal to people who seek work. Maybe it's time to do a competitive analysis of your business. What salaries do your competitors pay? How do they manage workers? Do they offer management training? Some of this information is easy to find out. Other pieces may take a bit more work. You can start by talking to other owners or managers, joining business groups in your community and networking, talking to your own employees, and talking to workers at other companies. The secret to building a successful team is looking beyond superficial elements, including an applicant's cover letter and resume, to find the right personality for your needs. Choosing a candidate with a winning personality, connections, and skills helps to ensure you will have an employee who does his or her part to help your business succeed. Once you find someone with the right personality for the job, you can teach her how to work in your business. Here is my view about teaching versus training. Training is a behavior modification, and that happens when you are a child. If you do not look in my eyes when you meet me as an adult, it is impossible to change that behavior. If you have low energy or you are impatient, I can't change those things. I don't train people. I teach the right people for me how to work in my business. A person with a great personality and no experience can be taught how to work in a business within 3 days. Personality is money. To that end, remember the following when hiring. Personality. I cannot emphasize this enough. The key to hiring customer-facing employees is personality, not skill set. If a person's personality and interpersonal skills seem right, then is past experience even relevant? It's easier to teach someone procedures, duties, and specifications than to teach him to change his personality. Look for employees who demonstrate empathy, curiosity, grit, and collaborative tendencies. These types of employees are guaranteed to be intrinsically motivated, and their hard work will definitely be a plus for your business. Connections. An employee with numerous solid connections to potential customers they could bring in or employees you could hire is priceless. When you harness the talent and energy that is in your combined network, you will be able to expand your reach and achieve your business objectives in a relatively efficient manner. Curiosity. In Cat's Cradle, Kurt Vonnegut wrote, "New knowledge is the most valuable commodity on earth. The more truth we have to work with, the richer we become." Hire people who can demonstrate an ability to learn, are flexible, and are curious about new information and ideas. Bullshit Buster. Mark Itkin. Highly respected and regarded as one of the architects of the modern television syndication and non-scripted reality television models, Mark Itkin, an agent and show packager at WME, is responsible for bringing many popular and influential shows to the small screen, including The Real World, Deal or No Deal, Extreme Makeover Home Edition, Project Runway, The People's Court, The Ricky Lake Show, and American Gladiators. Mark was also a pioneer in identifying international programming that could be successfully adapted to American TV, including Big Brother, Fear Factor, and Hell's Kitchen. In short, Mark is the guy who can come up with an idea, find the right performers and production companies to make the show, pitch new concepts and ideas to networks, and make it all work. The popularity and profitability of reality TV are really because of Mark Itkin. Mark is also a business partner of mine and one of my best friends. When I started to develop Bar Rescue, I wrote up a brief about the show, which was originally called On the Rocks. I then met with Michael Braverman, a manager for entertainers and my first advisor in the television business. One of his jobs was to introduce me to industry people, and one of the people he wanted me to meet was Mark Itkin. "You have to meet Mark. He is the god of unscripted TV," he said. Today, about 70% of all shows are unscripted, and most of them went through Mark's hands at some point. I tried to talk to Mark for 2 years, but he would not return my phone calls. I emailed him, called, did whatever I could to meet him. It was frustrating. By this time, Bar Rescue was in production and on the air. I had moved to another agency, and things were moving along. The show was doing well in the ratings, and we were being renewed. Out of the blue, 2 years into the show, I received a call from, of all people, Mark Itkin. This was a big deal. He finally noticed me. I went to the WME building to meet him in his beautiful corner office. Within minutes, we hit it off and were talking like old friends. Mark represented me for 1.5 years, up until his retirement. We still collaborate on projects even today. Mark's tenacity and ability to put disparate pieces together to create cohesive entertainment continues to amaze me. When Mark started in the mailroom at the William Morris Agency, WME's predecessor, unscripted television was considered a low-rent area, even though people like Oprah, Mark Goodson, and Merv Griffin had done very well and become quite wealthy from this kind of programming. Most of the other people in the mailroom wanted to be actors' agents, writers' agents, movie agents, or work on primetime drama or comedy. These were the areas that had cachet and respect, says Mark. I didn't want to be like everyone else. However, he points out that one person before him who was packaging game and other daytime TV shows was Mike Ovitz, co-founder of the talent agency CAA and a huge player in the movie business. I had done a dissertation on daytime TV at UCLA. I knew it and watched it. I grew up as a middle-class kid where there was no snobbery, and I could watch everything. I really had very middle-class tastes. I was not a snob, and I got a feel when something could work or had the elements or had a cool title. When I thought about it, it made sense to work in daytime, which eventually morphed into primetime reality programming. I was the first guy to do it. None of the other agents were doing it because it just wasn't considered cool, Mark says. He consciously chose a path that at the time did not have a great deal of respect in the industry, nor a lot of notice from higher-ups. For some people, that circumstance would have been a difficult one to traverse. It wasn't exactly a clear path to success and recognition. Mark didn't care. No one really understood what I did, and few really knew about this kind of TV or what it could be, so they let me do my thing, he says. I built the non-scripted department completely under the radar. I started accumulating various people in the arena of non-scripted TV and eventually became the go-to guy in that because I planted the flag early on. Another reason why Mark was able to take his less-than-glamorous circumstances, or so they were considered at the time, and make them so successful, was that he took the programming seriously. If I had a feeling in my gut that an idea or personality was exciting, then it was really worth spending some time on. I didn't want the buyer to ruin it, so I would look for the right people to produce it so that wouldn't happen. He also looked for overseas programming that could work in the American market. I would look through boxes full of tapes of shows from clients such as John DeMol for anything with potential. Most of it was garbage, but 10% was worth looking at. One show from Belgium was basically two teams of people who had to do these amazing stunts. For example, someone put on a uniform that protected him and let an angry German shepherd bite him while he ran from one spot to another. That show became Fear Factor. Mark was able to make such a success out of an overlooked part of the industry because of his knowledge base. Growing up, he watched TV, and he studied it in school. But he also made an effort to understand the history of television and why people like certain shows. He advises anyone who may feel their career circumstances are limited to educate themselves. The more you know, the more options you have. Don't assume the circumstances you are in can't lead to something hugely influential and lucrative. Mark's story proves that you can succeed by flipping the script on what you think of as an obstacle and making it an advantage. Today, Mark is a legend because he took that route. Bullshit Buster. Christine King, medical exercise specialist. Christine King is the founder and CEO of Your Best Fit, Inc. She started her own company after a horrific, life-altering jet ski accident that left her paralyzed and nearly killed her. Christine was vice president of a video production company and training for a Miss Fitness USA competition. On a summer weekend in New England, she was jet skiing with some friends when they hit a wave, and she was thrown 20 feet in the air before landing back on the jet ski in a seated position. When Christine opened her eyes and looked down at her legs, she says they looked like two ropes that had been twisted, and I could not undo them. At that moment, she saw the whole rest of her life in a wheelchair. Her friends surrounded her, and together they swam her back to shore as they were about 200 feet out in the water. From there, Christine was put on a very slim wooden stretcher and loaded onto the back of a pickup truck, then slowly driven to the waiting ambulance, which could not drive onto the sandy beach. At the hospital, she finally got up the courage to ask a technician, "Did I break my back?" It was a devastating moment because she could tell by the look in his eyes that the answer was yes. The local hospital could not handle her injuries, so Christine was put in a medevac and brought to Rhode Island Hospital, where she was taken into the trauma unit. 10 to 15 doctors surrounded me, trying to decide the best course of action. "I was 26 years old," she recalls. Despite the devastating news about her back and legs, Christine felt like she was in a good place. "My career was going well, and I read a lot of business books and success books, so I had many good things in my head. I'm a Christian, so I could lean on that, too. I'm half Italian and half Irish, so I am thick-headed. I went home too early, but I was in the gym on Monday after going home on Friday in a full body cast. I would exercise anything that would move. Little by little, I started to get things back. My therapy was 8 hours a day. I would not accept the fact that I was not going to walk again." After 20 years in the fitness business, Christina says that if you can move any part of your body, build on that movement. Over time, she got rid of the braces and the canes, which she credits to being in great shape before her accident. Her journey inspired her to leave the video production company and start helping other people change their lives through fitness. "I want to show people how fitness can help them too. I became certified as a personal trainer, and through the hardships of my physical and personal life, I kept building my personal training company and moving forward, and still do it to this day. Today, Christine and her team work with everyone, from children to adults, and from athletes to people with injuries. We are going to get you to do what you can do," she says. "Many people come to us not believing they can get better. Menopausal women say, 'I will never lose weight.' You can do it, and you do not have to kill yourself to do it. You have to make it realistic. It can be done. You can still do what you want to do. If you are paralyzed from the waist down, you can move your upper body, and you can become the best chef. You can't always listen to the doctors. I've seen people do miraculous things with their legs after the time limit set by doctors. Don't give up." Christine turned what could have been a devastating circumstance into the impetus to do something very different with her life. An accident could have become a whopper of an excuse, but Christine chose to let her circumstances become her inspiration. Bullshit Buster, Ed Meek. In 1983, Ed Meek was running his publishing company, Oxford Publishing, which put out a handful of national trade magazines on topics ranging from hospitality to satellite communications to healthcare. That year, he bought Nightclub and Bar magazine from Ole Miss graduate Lori Heavey after the publication ran into some financial troubles. As a natural entrepreneur and idea man, Ed thought that a small trade show would benefit bar owners as well, so he put together a few educational speakers who were successful and knowledgeable about the bar business and quickly organized an event. "I met Ed around this time, when I was a young guy in the bar business. He asked me to speak at the convention, and it's grown larger than either of us would have thought. Today, the event is described as the largest food and beverage trade show in the Western Hemisphere, and Ed was named one of the top 100 most influential people in the trade show industry by Trade Show Week magazine. Now held in Las Vegas, the convention draws about 32,000 buyers and more than 2,000 exhibitors. When he started this event, Ed didn't know anything about the bar and restaurant business, and coming from the Bible Belt and a very conservative teetotaler background, he wasn't going to begin learning about it now. He went into a business he knew nothing about, and one whose entire product line he avoided. For many, that could prove to be a negative circumstance, but for Ed it was a winning strategy. I was publishing magazines in niche markets and in subjects I didn't know anything about," he says. Instead, Ed learned that you can make an idea happen by going to the experts. "My mother would have rolled over in her grave had she known about the nightclub business I had entered. However, I saw a great opportunity, a great need that I could fill by hiring the right people, so I never let my personal feelings enter into it," says Ed. Together, we and the others whom he guided in the business aspects put together a product that grew and grew. I would keynote every show because I could draw a crowd like no one else. Ed also says that no matter the circumstances, you have to persevere and believe in yourself. My success is based on finding ideas and staying with them until I make them happen, despite circumstances. I taught for 36 years, and I always noticed it was not the straight-A students who have done well in life. It was the average grade ladies and men in the back of the class who were motivated and stayed with their ideas no matter what happened. There are two books that Ed says changed his life and helped him to overcome any difficult circumstances and reach his goals. The first is Success Through a Positive Mental Attitude by Napoleon Hill and W. Clement Stone. It made me believe in the power of positive thinking because I've seen it work in my own life so many times. If you train yourself to think about ideas, you can make them happen. I write ideas down all the time, when I'm traveling, waiting in line, everywhere. I keep a notebook with me to jot down ideas that later become businesses, and I credit a lot of my success with that book. Among the ideas was my observation during a trip somewhere that my small town didn't have a convenience store. When I got back home, I set upon creating a convenience store in my town, and that store still exists, says Ed. The second book Ed recommends is How to Get Control of Your Time and Your Life by Alan Lakin. Good entrepreneurs by nature can be terrible organizers, so you have to force yourself to give time and attention to what is important, and that little book helped me do that. It's a short, simple book, but what great advice. Lakin says don't ever touch a piece of paper more than once. If the paper is worth acting on, act on it now, and if it isn't worth anything, get rid of it. Another strategy Lakin offers is to simply make a to-do list of what you will do tomorrow and put the most important thing on top. Do that before you do anything else on the list. What you find is that you may never do the C's on the list, but if you do the C's, you will never get to the A's and B's, the really important stuff. You're going to be confronted with negative and positive events and side effects outside your control throughout life and work. You have the wherewithal to deal with them. There is never going to be a perfect time or a perfect situation to make your business or life work, so don't wait for them to come along. With Bar Rescue, I've met many bar owners who refuse to adapt to circumstances, and that is why they fail. The key to handling circumstances, whatever they are, is being able to adapt to whatever is going on around you in ways that profit you. You have to learn to be agile and adaptable, and to be able to adjust to the inevitable and the unexpected. Understand that you exist to serve customers and clients. The customers don't exist to make business convenient or easy for you. Things go wrong. Circumstances do change. Accidents happen. And you will make mistakes. Expect them. Be ready for them. Adapt or die. DBY to-do list. Take a second or third look. Take the existing environment and adapt to it so you can serve existing stakeholders and attract new ones. See unchangeable circumstances not as obstacles that allow you to give up, but as opportunities for growth. Successful, excuse-free people work with what they have. Come on, get happy. If you have a tendency to see all or most barriers as impenetrable to your success and well-being, you have to do a little work to change that. If you're not naturally optimistic, you can practice being optimistic. Begin by not putting so much stock into what other people think. Don't use toxic people and situations as an excuse for toxic reactions. You choose how you behave, react, and respond. Learn from the past, but don't live there. Don't get caught up in the constant social media information loop. Engage your community and become part of it. Flip the script. Actively question your negative assumptions about your situation. Deal with existing conditions. Don't be defined by them. Bottom line, every problem has a solution. If you really think that your location is the problem, you have to do one of two things. Move your location or make the location work for you. If you stay, the trick is to make your place compelling. Likewise, the secret to building a successful team is looking beyond superficial elements, including an applicant's cover letter and resume, to find the right personality for your needs. Chapter 5. Excuse number 5. Ego. Avoid having your ego so close to your position that when your position falls, your ego goes with it. Colin Powell, American statesman and retired four-star general. Excuses based on internal beliefs and bad habits. Our egos are more than happy to provide us with self-definitions that help us avoid responsibility for our inactions or actions. Our egos also allow us to indulge in behaviors we should avoid. We give in to temptation because we want to feel good in the short term. We want immediate gratification, even if in the end it does not serve us. The ego wants to be both fed and shielded from harm. What we believe about ourselves as far as what we can and can't do is often our biggest obstacle. It's time for us to get over ourselves. I know that ego excuses usually have very little to do with reality, but they are comfortable and easy to believe. We go along with these excuses to protect our egos from possible disappointment and embarrassment. Psychologists call the device we use to distance ourselves from potential unpleasantness a defense mechanism. According to psychologist Angela Maya Singh Bass, Ph.D., making excuses is an effective way to either self-rationalize or manipulate an external situation or persons. Instead of dealing with old wounds and hurts from childhood and life, the ego subconsciously blocks out any information that triggers and does not support, bolster, or promote its well-being. The problem is that when we let our egos get in the way of action, we also distance ourselves from success, prosperity, progress, and realizing our full potential. In order to get rid of negative self-talk and an ego that doesn't want you to get out of your comfort zone, you need to believe in an alternative opinion of yourself through action. Hillel the Elder, the leader of the Jewish Supreme Court in Israel in the early part of the 1st century CE, said, "If I am not for myself, who will be for me? And if not now, when?" Words to live by. After speaking at a Budweiser convention in Las Vegas in 2010, an audience member suggested that I would be great on television. I had never considered being on television, but this encouragement gave me the impetus I needed to write up a treatment, or short description, for a show idea I had. I showed it to producers at Paramount and was told, "John, you will never be on television. Hosts are young and good-looking. You are too old and not good-looking enough. Don't waste your time." Rejection turned into inspiration. Instead of walking away with my tail between my legs, I got my pit bull on. Getting on TV became a vendetta for me. I used my own money to shoot a 3-minute sizzle reel in Hermosa Beach, California, which pretty much showed me screaming and yelling at bar owners. I brought it to 3 production companies. They all wanted it and sent me offers within a week. In my case, I used my ego to get my ambition into overdrive and fulfill my goal of developing and starring in a very high-quality and informative unscripted TV show. Get rid of the story you've made up about yourself or that you have allowed other people to foster and find the truth. When you hear yourself saying, "I'm too old, too young, too short or tall, too fat or thin, I'm not as good as, not as attractive as, my friends and family don't think I can or should do this, I don't have anyone to do this with, it's all about who you know, and I don't know anyone who can help me, I've had a terrible day, so I deserve to do X, even though it's bad for me, I am upset, or angry, or anxious, etc., so I have to do this to feel better, I am excited and happy, so I have to do this to celebrate, I am never going to change, so I will just give in. Just one more time, and then I'll start on Monday." It's time to give yourself some love and stop bullshitting yourself. It's not too late. We often make ego excuses regarding our age, which is too bad. I believe that nothing is too late until your heart stops beating. If you are listening to this, you are alive, so it's not too late. You have the ability to change things, challenge the status quo, beat the odds, and start something new. Yes, there is always going to be someone younger, richer, thinner, smarter, and more charming than you out there. That's the way the world works. Face it, I match no television executive's typical description of what a perfect host or even reality character looks, talks, or walks like. Here I am, defying some imaginary odds, the central character in a show that I created. Bar Rescue premiered in 2011, and as of this writing, is going into its sixth season with more than 150 episodes and more than 70 million viewers on a television network primarily directed at young males. An astounding 77 million people watched season 4. I just finished shooting a pilot for ABC, my first network project, and we are now finalizing a talk show. We are shown in 5 continents and on more than 5,000 channels and dubbed in Portuguese, Italian, and Spanish. We are negotiating even more shows, taking us close to 200 episodes, which is unheard of in the reality TV space. Bar Rescue's success is past anything I could have imagined. How the hell did that happen? One reason the show is such a hit is because I refuse to think about or take seriously the conventional idea of what a TV host should be. I just did not let the fact that I did not fit the existing criteria deter me. There's no law that says a TV host has to be 25 and a former bodybuilder. Media, and all business, like to repeat success, so they tend to piggyback on what works and are afraid to get out of that comfort zone. That's why you see copycats of so many successful products. This doesn't mean you can't do something completely different and get your stakeholders, whether suppliers or customers, out of their comfort zones. The producers and I knew we had something good. I knew I could pull it off, and I projected that confidence. You are not to anything, old, young, pretty, plain, whatever, to try something and succeed. There are other unlikely television people who have made it in an industry that seems obsessed with youth and beauty. Ina Garten, host of Barefoot Contessa on the Food Network, is not tall, thin, or young. Yet she has one of the most successful franchises in the food world. She was 54 when her show debuted in 2002. Or take actor Reed Birney, born in 1954, who won Best Featured Actor in a Play at the 2016 Tony Awards for his role in The Humans. During his acceptance speech, Birney said something remarkable. "The last thing I want to say is I've been an actor for almost 42 years, which I cannot believe I am saying. All 35 of them were pretty bad, and that's a lot of them, and I just couldn't get anything going. So the last 8 have been great. But the thing that was always great wherever I was, whatever level I was on, were the amazing people I got to work with. Almost all of them were hilarious and talented and full of passion and joy, and they loved putting on plays and telling stories. They always have been and are still the best part of what I do, and I am so grateful to all of you, and I love sharing the planet with all of you." Here is someone who had been toughing it out in a difficult industry for 42 years, never throwing in the towel. Birney finally got a great part and won a Tony Award after many years of pounding the pavement and being rejected. Yet he's tremendously grateful despite the difficult road he traveled. Harry Bernstein published a short story back in 1934 when he was 24 years old. Yet it was not until 2007, when he was 96 years old, that he published a memoir, The Invisible Wall, about growing up Jewish and poor in a northern English mill town. During the 1950s, Mr. Bernstein, who died in 2011 at 101, tried to make a living as a writer, and did sell work to the New York Daily News, Popular Mechanics, and Family Circle. Eventually, he ended up editing Home of Tomorrow, a construction trade magazine. He published a novel in 1981, but it sold poorly. "The first 25 years of my life are something I would rather forget, but the contrary has taken place," he told The Guardian in 2007. "The older I get, the more alive those years have become." He published 2 more books, one a follow-up memoir, published in 2008, and a third in 2009. Reflecting on his path, Harry said, "If I had not lived until I was 90, I would not have been able to write this book. It just could not have been done, even when I was 10 years younger. I wasn't ready. God knows what other potentials lurk in other people, if we could only keep them alive well into their 90s. Next time you're tempted to use age as an excuse, think of me and think of Harry Bernstein. Be who you are. Not only can we talk ourselves out of something because we feel too old, we can also tell ourselves lies about other attributes, like our appearance, and how being too something else will stop us from doing something we want to do. At 45, Brett Singer decided to finally take a crack at professional acting after years of thinking he was too tall to be an actor. I had gone to the High School of Performing Arts, and I acted, produced, and directed in college, and even started my own theater company, he says. When I got out of college, I could have started auditioning for things, but out of fear, I just didn't. I thought at 6'3" I was too tall to be an actor. Brett wasn't wrong. Truth be told, most actors are small in stature. Tom Cruise, Daniel Radcliffe, Al Pacino, James McAvoy, and many other leading men are well under 6 feet tall. When someone who is very tall is working with someone much shorter, it is hard to shoot scenes unless you want to have an obvious difference in characters' heights. Even so, height is still not a reason not to try acting. Rules exist to be broken. Instead, Brett went into theater administration, and from there he found his way into the publicity business. I had my own theater publicity business, enough to support my family while my wife was in law school, but the interest in acting never went away. I had young children, and I was not in a good financial position, nor did I think of myself as an actor, says Brett. Eventually, Brett transitioned from PR to journalism, as writing was something he also liked to do. Still, acting nagged at his soul. He didn't feel ready to give up his day job, and wondered if he had enough time to go on countless auditions and still earn enough money to provide for his family. Now, not only did he think he might be too tall, he also thought he might be too old. The fact that people like Michael Caine or Samuel L. Jackson keep working into old age inspired me. When he realized he could take the time to go on auditions and acting didn't necessarily have to bring in income, he decided to listen to his heart and give acting a go. What really changed his mind? You start to get older, and you realize you will not live forever. You start to listen less to your ego and more to what you really want to do, or you should. I also wanted my kids to learn that through me. The fact is, the height factor and the age factor was really all in Brett's head. A friend from college had started a theater company in San Francisco, and he called Brett wondering if he would be willing to do a reading. I said, sure. Not only was it an incredibly fun script, but when I did the reading, everybody there said, oh my God, you're really good. That doesn't hurt. Despite the fact that I never allowed myself to think of acting as an option, I also have a, sure, I'll try that, attitude about most things. After he did that reading, he was asked to do another reading, and then was asked to do a monologue by a former classmate who is now a producer. I took a class to brush up on my training, and I also signed up for Backstage Magazine, which lists almost all open auditions. Once you pay for a subscription, you can go to backstage.com and upload your resume and headshot. That way you can click on auditions and apply right from home. It's like Candy Crush for actors, says Brett. The subscription had already paid for itself by the time we talked, as it had helped Brett land several paying acting gigs. It took nerve and willingness to open up to rejection, which is a big part of auditioning. You go out and stand there and read for someone, and then they say, no, we do not want you. It's still a lot of fun. The only way to do it is to actually try doing it, so I don't mind the rejection. Rejection doesn't do anything to my ego because I know I'm not going to get every part. No one does. I'm old enough to know how lucky I am. Every week, after an episode of Bar Rescue, someone insults my actions or appearance on social media. Those insults never bother me, nor can I take them personally. Allowing rejection to impact me would kill my ability to be on television, just as it would damage anyone's feeling of self-worth. But only if you let it bother you. 5 ways to flip your script. The personality that cannot change is really the personality that refuses to change. When you believe yourself is flawed in such a way that it stops you from pursuing your dreams, that's a self-pity play. The self-pity play denies you self-respect, and if you really believe trash talk about yourself, you should close your business tomorrow because you will never be successful with that attitude. Your attitude. You own it. However, if you know you're lying to yourself and you're indulging in feeling sorry for yourself, you have a chance. Self-pity is just a trap, but it's one you can get out of. When you feel this way about yourself, it's generally masking another problem, likely another one of the excuses in this book. Identify the underlying issue that leads to pathetic and immobilizing self-pity. You may feel you don't know enough to run a business or continue working in your role at your job. While it may be true that another job may suit you better, feeling sorry for yourself doesn't change anything. You need to make it your business to learn about the things you don't know about. If you're worried about money, read the money chapter. If you're worried about your employees, pick up a book on management. Wrapping yourself in self-pity spoils any chance of being able to see new possibilities as they appear. Agreeing to live with regrets ensures only that they'll still be with you tomorrow. Why would you want that? I've seen this syndrome so many times, especially in the tough arenas of hospitality and retail, that I just had to figure out something uncomplicated people could do to change their own attitudes. The following strategies force you to pause and question your beliefs. Implement a zero-tolerance policy for your own dark feelings. You have to consciously stop the pity narrative that is running endlessly in your brain. Because you have free will, you can stop yourself from thinking dark thoughts. Visualize throwing away negative feelings, or literally do it. Write down dark emotions on a piece of paper, and then crumple it up or set it on fire. Safely, of course. List in your mind or on paper everything that is going right in your life. This helps you see that your negative thoughts are out of whack with the reality of your life. Gratitude helps us become more appreciative of what we have. Every day, recommit to stop joining in when the pity party comes calling. It's not going to be easy. The ingrained patterns in your brain feel comfortable, even when they encourage self-pity. Practice being positive. Healthy self-esteem prevents you from being caught up in self-pity and is a defense against criticism that can often stop your progress. I'm not asking you to ignore what could be constructive criticism. I am asking you to respond to it in sensible ways that help you move forward. Regular exercise, even 20 to 30 minutes a day, is one way. Eating better and drinking less are essential. Take time to do some community service and get to know or reach out to other people in your industry. Try something that is out of your natural comfort zone. Learn solid financial management. Learn that you don't need to spend money to be happy and that the things you own don't define your worth. Finally, get a little gratitude in your life. No matter how little you think you have many things to be grateful for, so start recognizing them. All of these things build self-confidence and get you out of your head. Ask yourself if it's really true. Do you have proof? When you say or think something about yourself, take a moment to ask yourself if it is really true or if it is just a story you tell yourself or someone else's story about you that you choose to believe. If something is true, does it make a difference in terms of what you're trying to accomplish? For example, if you say, I'm too overweight to work in sales, is that because you've tried to get a job in sales and have been turned down specifically because you are overweight, or is it all in your head? If it is true, weight is something you can work on, but it should not stop you from seeking or getting a job. Instead of telling yourself you can't get a job because of your size, start telling yourself you can get a job because of your personality, qualifications, and talent. Changing negative self-talk to positive ideas that are true works over time. Steve Buscemi is an incredible actor with amazing credits to his name. He's not exactly George Clooney in the looks department, but that doesn't make a difference at all in terms of his success. What if he had told himself, I am not as traditionally handsome as many leading men in Hollywood, so I should give up on an acting career. Did it mean he couldn't be a successful actor? No, absolutely not. Professional cartoonist Robin Ha grew up in Seoul, South Korea, and stayed out of the kitchen, leaving that task to her mother. I always thought cooking was something I could never do. Korean food looks really complicated, Ha told NBC News. However, a few years after graduating from the Rhode Island School of Design, Ha moved to Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, where there were no Korean restaurants. She asked her mother for simple recipes and slowly began to make Korean food in her modest Brooklyn kitchen. The more recipes she successfully made, the more she understood that not only could she cook, she was becoming very good at it. After becoming beyond proficient in Korean cooking, her friends took note and started asking her for tips and recipes. As a result, in 2014, She started a weekly comic on Tumblr, Panchan in 2 pages, to explain how to make basic Korean side dishes. An editor from 10 Speed Press noticed its popularity and asked Ha if she would be interested in turning the material into a cookbook. In July 2016, the then 35-year-old cartoonist published Cook Korean. "I haven't been educated in culinary school or in a kitchen," she says. Nevertheless, Ha stopped listening to that idea, her own, that she couldn't cook. Because there was no proof she couldn't cook, she went ahead and tried it out of necessity. Look where it took her. What do you tell yourself that holds you back? Is it true? Do you have proof? When you buy a house, you don't just look at the front of it and make a decision. Even professional house flippers who are buying quickly try to look in the windows and walk the perimeter of the property before making an offer. Most people know it is wise to look at the front of the house, the sides, the back, the basement, and the roof, and examine all the rooms before proceeding with a buy. Are you giving yourself the same courtesy of investigating your assumptions? Don't compare yourself with others. Comparing your progress, wealth, appearance, social standing, and other markers of success with people in your peer group is human nature. It's tough not to do, I get that. Comparing certain aspects of your life, such as your retirement savings or your cholesterol levels, with members of your demographic can even serve as a benchmark, something you can learn from. It's not the final word on your own situation, but it gives you some information you can use to make positive changes. We get into trouble when we use comparisons to deny ourselves the right to take action. The "I'm not good enough" ego excuse is based on looking at others and deciding they are better, and their levels of achievement are somehow unreachable for you. You don't have to try particularly hard to find someone who looks like they are doing better than you, and as a consequence, to feel bad about it. A 2005 study published in the Quarterly Journal of Economics called Neighbors as Negatives, Relative Earnings and Well-Being, found that higher earnings of neighbors were associated with lower levels of self-reported happiness. In other words, people felt bad about themselves if they thought their neighbors made more money than they did. Erzo F. P. Luttmer, the author of the study, and an associate professor of economics at Dartmouth College, told the New York Times that neighbors influence what you think is a normal lifestyle, and you struggle to keep up. The struggle can distract you from things you could and should be doing to make your life better by directing you toward things that you think will impress the neighbors, who probably don't care or even think all that much about you. You may be avoiding challenging yourself to do better because you feel defeated. Ultimately, comparisons put the focus on the wrong person, and that is the person or group you are comparing yourself with. The focus should be on you. The self-criticism that results leads to a distorted sense of reality and the inability to learn from mistakes, according to a study by Michael Inslicht, Ph.D., a psychologist at the University of Toronto, and his colleagues. "I have worked with more than one bar and small business owner who failed because they had comparison paralysis. They were so defeated by how their neighbors were doing, they just stopped trying to be competitive and closed up shop." Give yourself some credit when comparison-based self-doubt creeps into your mind. When you're tempted to start comparing yourself with those you perceive as doing better, remember that it's just a perception because you never have the whole picture of another person's life and business. You can also make note of some of the great things you have going for you. University of Colorado psychologist Joshua Correll, Ph.D., found that people who identify things they value and own, such as their families, laughter, creative pursuits, and so on, reduce their anxiety and increase their ability to solve problems and improve upon real flaws. Focus on your own successes. Find inspiration through authentic knowledge seeking. Looking at what successful people do is worthwhile only if the information gleaned is instructive and useful. Find out what the most successful people in your field do and learn what you can emulate to achieve your own goals. Peers, industry leaders, well-known success stories, people you know personally, and those whom you know about only because of their notoriety, all are great resources as inspirational examples. Walt Disney has long been an inspiration for me, and even though he is long gone, his legacy and his business acumen are a constant source of insight. Compare with yourself. Compete with yourself. Look at where you were 5 years or 12 months ago. What has improved? What can you do better? What's the best you've ever done at something? How can you beat your own record? Positive self-tracking is a great way to stay motivated and on task. Also, get some fresh air. A change of scenery, even if it's a walk around the block, can help clear your head of negative self-talk and comparison mode. According to a study done by researchers at the University of Michigan, nature walks are associated with improved well-being and lower perceived stress. Researchers found that people who walked reduced the effects of stress in their lives and improved their emotional and psychological well-being. I know when I am out driving my tour bus, something I love to do, the stress of the day disappears as I take in the sights and sounds of the open road. Give it time. Don't slow down your own progress or the progress of others just because you don't see any immediate gratification down the road. Successful and productive people see the greater reward of a successful company and want to play a part in building something cool that will benefit them down the line. Three core skills go right to the heart of the time is running out thought and the there's nothing in it for me anyway syndrome. Three things absolutely necessary for success are the ability to plan for the future, delaying gratification, and something called commonweal orientation, or a general concern for the well-being of your community. You can see entire groups of people who are unable to get out of a cycle of poverty and failure because they cannot think of anything except their current needs and are unable to wait for and work toward something better. Instead of saving up for something they might actually need to succeed, like a car or a college education, they buy expensive sneakers or a fancy cell phone instead. The famous marshmallow study shows this clearly. In the study, researchers told children that they could have a marshmallow right now, but if they waited for a defined period of time, they could get two marshmallows. Some children gobbled up the marshmallow, and others waited patiently so they could have twice the fun. In a follow-up to the study, researchers found that those who had been able to wait for a second marshmallow succeeded better in school, in their careers, and in life than those who could not wait. Cancel your subscription to negativity. Negativity is an infectious disease that has dire consequences. The eye-rollers, complainers, and whiners with short fuses and quick tempers wear people out with their temper tantrums and constant grievances. All-or-nothing thinking, when you think anything less than perfection or anything less than everything you want is failure, is unproductive. The person who focuses only on the negative aspects of any situation denies reality. Negative thinkers who project their own bad feelings onto others and misinterpret what other people say ruin productive relationships. Negative thinking can also have bad outcomes for your health and well-being. People who get into a cycle of chronic why-me thinking are at a higher risk for late-onset depression and a decline in cognitive function, according to a study from the University of New South Wales. Another study linked high levels of cynicism later in life to a greater risk of dementia, and a research project that looked at data from almost 100,000 women found that the most pessimistic participants were more likely to have heart disease than positive-thinking women. Additionally, the more negative thinkers had a higher chance of dying over the study period compared with the more positive group. According to a 2014 hostility study, unfriendly people had a higher risk of stroke than the friendlier study subjects. An addiction to negativity isn't good for your career either. In my experience, managers consider negative employees a drain on morale and productivity. Eventually, they get rid of them before the damage they do gets too severe. Employees have no respect for negative managers or owners and will either quit or stop paying attention and allow their work to slide and their responsibilities to take a back seat to other concerns. Unfortunately, negativity is a common habit among the failing business owners I meet, which is why I talk so much about changing someone's thinking first before changing anything about his business. Too many people automatically see the bad before the good in any situation. They gossip, whine, and complain. At one bar I tried to rescue in Las Vegas, the owner could not kick his habit of being cynical and angry. He abused his employees and customers, and his attitude killed the ambience of what could have been a fun bar in a great location. The owner refused to show up on the opening night of his renovated and rebranded bar, and in fact, refused to even open the bar after we left. His own negativity was ruinous. He gutted the place and planned to renovate and reopen the bar. But it never happened. Negative thinking also kills creativity,